If correctly listening to such an instruction can reach immense advantages. Page number 114. You may wonder from what kind of person you should hear the superior teaching. In general, the sutras and tantras and the greater and the lesser vehicles give various definitions of teachers from whom it is appropriate to hear the holy dharma. However, the spiritual master who are kind enough to give an instruction as precious as this one, according to the ornament of Mahayana sutras, should be disciplined by training in ethical discipline, pacified by training and concentration, and thoroughly pacified by training and wisdom. In other words, they should have the quality of realization, that is, a mind tamed by three trainings. Furthermore, they should have the quality of scriptural knowledge, having extensively studied the Tripitaka and so forth. They should have the wisdom of an excellent understanding of thusness and the qualities that are superior to those of their disciples. These are the six features that Dharma teachers should have acquired. They should also be thoroughly aware of the steps of the spiritual path that they intend to explain and have skill in teaching so that their followers may gain access to their meaning. They should have no concern for personal gain, honors, and so forth, and instead should be motivated by compassion. I think I jumped a page. I think I have read that before. I think it's the same. So what is the majority? I will go after the majority. I'm sure that this is the paragraph. So if anything is left, you must let me know. These are the six features that Dharma teachers should have acquired. They should also be thoroughly aware of the steps of the spiritual path they intend to explain. And this is what Lama Tsongkhapa explained in the great treatise of the Path to Enlightenment, that if yourself or oneself is not transformed or tamed, there is no way that you can guide others to transform their mind. And also the means of how to transform or tame oneself should be depending upon through the great extensive explanations that is being existing in the great texts and sutras. So this is really true. And when we speak about giving teaching, and it is mainly for transforming one's negative mind. So it's very important that the one who gives the teaching should have a transformed mind or a calm mind before describing or explaining others how to do it. If you have to guide someone to stop drinking, and oneself should be stopped from drinking alcohol. So if you too consume alcohol, and there is no way that you can guide others in stopping or prohibiting the drink of alcohol. So therefore, whatever you demonstrate or explain others, it is very important that oneself should be in the path of practicing those very essences. And if the disciple points at the master, that it is also existing in the great Lama Rinpoche, that the disciple may point to the master that first you need to practice yourself before you tell us. So for example, even in schools, the education of the students depend upon the quality of the teachers that we have. If we have very quality teachers, then of course the education and the studies of the students will be improved. And not just the education or the studies or that quality of the teacher, but the teacher should be compassionate towards the students. He should be a warm heart so that when the teacher explains or give teaching to the students, the students will, with the a compassionate hurt or whether very willingly hurt will listen to the teacher. If the teacher is a very fierce one or not being compassionate or kind to the student, so even though he may give a lot of advice and the teachings, but the student won't listen to him. So therefore, someone who gives teaching to other is something that first one needs to have the understanding of what one gives the teaching. And the second, it's very important that one needs to have the implementation or the practice of what you're teaching. So with these two qualities, then if you explain or demonstrate other people about this, then of course it will bring a better result. And the summary and the outcome of it is that with such a practice that there will be such a change in one's mind, then you should be able to instruct your disciple in this way. So the disciples will think that whatever our masters or the teachers tell us, he is speaking from his own experience or practice, and the students will feel confident to follow the advice and the teachers. Therefore, the master should be a very qualified one with all the characteristics to be spiritual masters. Therefore, Lord Buddha speaks about the importance of Vinaya, and inside the Vinaya, they're speaking about one's own master, one's own resident master. In terms of the Vinaya, the resident master is considered very important. Then in terms of the sutra, it speaks that the master should be containing 10 different qualities. Then when it comes to the tantra or the practice of Vajrayana, then there is a different qualities and the criteria to be a master of initiations or conferring initiations. So therefore, just having a title or a name of a good master than just attending the initiations or the teaching without having any checked or analyzing the master, it is a wrong way. As Sajja Pandita Rinpoche says that, so in order to find the precious gems, so even though I do not remember all the votes, so the final destiny of our life is depend upon the teaching of the Buddha. So therefore, it is very important that we have to receive the teaching from one's master. So it's very important that we have to check. It should not be just from its rank or having a great followers or having a great throne. This should not be taken into account when one looks for one's own master. The qualities should be present. The qualities of understanding and the qualities of practice for oneself. So having these two qualities, one becomes a complete master, and one has to look for the master who has both these qualities in them. And I used to tell, I think for 15 to 20 years, I used to tell everyone that when many Buddhists coming from China many years back, once in Dharamsala, a few Chinese devotees came to see me in Dharamsala, and he told me that. And nowadays, there are a lot of Dhammarajas who claim themselves to be the king of Dhamma teachers who come to China to give teachings. And when the devotees respect them, saying that the king of the teachers is coming and offer money, and after doing all these things, so as the time passes, as the time goes on, what they require is the women and the money. And he told me that it's really, everybody generates a wrong view in the sense of this master. So therefore, he asked me to guide me. How can we avoid these things? I told him that there is nothing that I can do. I am here as a refugee, and there is nothing that I can do in Tibet. So those of you who are interested in the teachings, and you must know what are the criteria and the characteristics of our masters. And when those who claim to be the king of the teachers come, you must check and analyze whether these masters contain all those qualities or not. And if they do not have all those qualities, then you should not consider them as masters or your guru. You can just consider him as a friend, and you can questions and answers about their teachings. But if you want them to be your masters, you must check them. So because the inside qualities, as we normally say, is that the tigers have the lions outside, as humans, the lions are inside. So therefore, as also in the Vinaya commentary by Kunjan Sonawa, he says that whatever the different kinds of the fish in the sea can be represented or can be seen by the movements of the water, the ripples upon the river. So similarly, through the characters of body, speech, and mind, the external characters will be able to show what their inside quality is. So after that, you can analyze not just from their scriptural knowledge, but what are their realizations or the inside knowledge, so one can analyze further. So therefore, it's very important that first we have to know what are the qualities that should be present in the master. Then until one becomes satisfied to know that these consider all this, those qualities, one should not look at them or consider them as their masters or gurus. Nowadays, when there are more and more people becoming devoted to teachings of Buddha, there happens to be more and more people or the monks who claim to be teachers who are actually a kind of businessman coming around. So we have to be very careful about those persons. Generally, those listening should be honest and have the ability to distinguish false from true innings and should be drawn to the excellent spiritual path. Moreover, they should respect the teaching and the teacher. These are the four requisites. A disciple ready to be guided by this path in particular need for further qualities. If one is the teacher or is biased or is not straightforward, then of course, even though he may have qualities, he will see the other people's qualities as their faults and he will see his own faults as qualities. So therefore, it's very important that it should not be biased. It should be a great master should be unbiased. I met a scientist before and he says that in his in his field of science, he is a philosopher. I mean, he is someone who is perfect in his own field. But he told me that he is not attached or desired towards his own field of science, which is really very true. And similarly, I am a practitioner of Lord Buddha, but I do not. I should not be getting attached to the teachings of the Buddha. I should be unbiased. So whatever I believe or say should be followed by reasoning. As it is in the praise of the Lord Buddha, say that I do not consider the Lord Buddha as a supreme teacher, not just being I myself is a Buddhist. So therefore, it is very important that one has to follow the reasons to make decisions. And Lord Buddha himself says that before taking me as your guru, you must analyze my words and my phrases, just as the gold is being checked in different manners. So this is a kind of a great freedom given to all disciples. So even in a general thing, that in our daily world, whenever you desire to have something out of a great attachment towards that, so there is a negative side to it. Of course, one should not be in the influence of the attachment of the desire, having an unbiased mind. And if you analyze, if you research further, there is a great possibility that the reality can be seen more clearer, whether it is a political or it's any other cases. If one becomes under the influence of desire and attachment, it is very difficult to see the reality. And one needs to take a realistic means to acquire your objective. So if we, other than that, if one falls under the influence of the afflicted emotions, then one will not be able to get what you desire. Even though you may take the wrong methods through your own desire, under the influence of desire, it will be very difficult. Even in our Tibetan course, we have a lot of discussion about the middle way approach and complete freedom. It is very good that we have a dialogue about among the people. And those who also claim that our policy should be complete freedom, and if it is from a sincere effort, it's really true. But if the mental state or if one's wishes are biased one, not based on reasoning or a real concern, then it's not effective. So generally, Lord Buddha's teaching is based on the reality of all the phenomena and the things. He speaks about two different wrong views, that criticizing other, and also those kind of ideas that consider something existing to be non-existing, kinds of nihilism. So therefore, the realistic approach should be free of all those attributions and all those additions. But then it doesn't mean that one should be considering everything as fact or real without check. It's a kind of a story that I'm going to tell you. When Devin Funzo Tashila, I think he was coming to Lhasa through India, and so he came to India, and so he cannot speak English. So someone asks him, he speaks about some English words, and when he asks something about when the person. So he replied everything and yes. Whatever the other person asked him, he replied merely with yes and yes. So since he doesn't understand English anything, so he just answered everything and yes. And later he was asking, why are you saying yes to all my questions? So in the presence of having an unbiased mind, and if you agree with everything, saying yes and yes to everything, then it's really not the correct one. Even the teaching of the Lord Buddha, there's something which is authentic, which has the origin and the source, which should be something can be felt experientially. And that kind of the teaching, we can accept it. So even though the explanations may be very beautiful, may seem very correct, but when we compare it to the great texts and the sutras, if there are contradictories, then of course one should be distanced from it. So therefore, it is very important that we should be able to distinguish between the right and the wrong. So therefore, it says one should have the ability to distinguish between the right and the wrong. And another thing is one should have the wish to do any kind of thing. So without having a wish, it is very impossible. It is almost impossible to follow any practice. Once you have page number 115, once you have correctly heard the explanation of the part of the three kinds of beings from a qualified spiritual master, how are you to practice? Personally, if you wish to become a teacher of this path, you should endeavor to acquire the attributes of a spiritual master. When you are listening, you should strive to secure the requisites of a listener. Once you have correctly heard the explanation of the path of three kinds of beings from a qualified spiritual master, how are you to practice? As Lama Tsongkhapa explains in the Lama Rinpoche's outlined at first how to rely upon a spiritual master and how to practice after that. And the first how to rely upon a spiritual master has two or four different things, speaking about how the qualities, the characteristics of a spiritual master, then the characteristics of a disciple, then how one should abide by it. So even though the master have all the qualities that is necessary, but if the disciple is someone who is biased, then the disciple doesn't become a qualified one. Therefore, how the disciple also seek the teacher, or how to listen to the teacher, is also important. First, in a harmonious place, you should set up images of the three jewels and arrange flowers, offering an attractive manner. So from here is the six preliminary practices. Sitting in Vajrasana on a comfortable seat, you take refuge many times in a heartfelt manner, truly thinking of what you are doing and putting your trust. And when we speak about sitting on a comfortable seat, so if somebody is sitting on a chair, if those who cannot sit on a cross legs, it's not necessary that we have to always sit on a cross leg. And in that way, if you're not comfortable, you will feel pains in your leg and it won't serve any purpose. So it's okay, it should be all right, even if you sit on a chair. But if you do not have any comfortable on sitting on lotus cross leg position, then you must sit in such position. And after that, there are, as it's explained in the swift mat and the easy mat, there are different postures. Which speaks about seven Vajrasana postures of the feet and your legs and also the, your tongues and the jaws. So there are eight or seven, so different postures. There is a way, it makes a lot of difference with your body postures, that your body is straight and also your neck and head is straight without falling on other sides. And it's not that it's not that you are looking totally upward in the sky. It's not so good. So it should be a little bit bent. So those who always raise their head too much will bring a lot of pride, which is when we went to China. Many scholars were gathered from different parts of Tibet, and one of my friends, whom I know, so I think I can tell the name is Kishu Ngudup Sonyi. He was with me, and among one of our discussions, and he is considered. And I asked him, is there an example that we can consider it as a pride, as a huge pride? And he says, he raised his head and he says, his beard coming, protruding out. And he sits in this area, and he told me that when someone seems to be full of pride, so if someone is very calm, normally his head is a little bit down. So, and even those who pretend to be having all the understanding, in reality, if they are not, so they raise their hand, they raise their head much more than is actually necessary. So if we sincerely feel that, thinking about all the afflicted emotions that we have, there is no way that we can raise our head so much. As it is said in the training of the eight verses of training, that we have to consider all the sentient beings as superior to ourselves. In terms of the animals, they are quite sincere and honest. As for the humans, we are dishonest. We are not so we are not respectful to anyone. So in those terms, we are even worse than those animals. So your head a little bit lower, and the tip of your tongue touching your jaw, and your left palm below and the right palm upon it, and the two thumbs meeting each other. And in future, so if you are practicing the heat, so you can press your two thumbs almost near your at the center of your body. And in terms of breath, if you concentrate everything, concentrate wholly about the breathing in and out, then it is also very good. But if you, other than that, if you concentrate mainly about your mental things, then it's more subtle and more difficult. But if you think external things, then it's more destructive. So the concentrating about your breathing in and out is a middle thing. So you have a high sensation of how the breathing comes in and out. And of course, your the mind that concentrate on it is also a little bit gross. And since your mind is also concentrating on it, it's more easy to develop a calm mind. So take one breath in, then breathe out, then breathe in. So if you did it for 24 times, some of my friends who say they counted it for 1,000 without distracting, just thinking merely about those breathing in and out. And as the time goes on for 15 to 20 minutes, this is that the time passes very quickly when one concentrates on it. So this is also a very good ways and a means to let your mind not to distract from all the conceptual mind that you have. So first, we have a very disturbed mind. So in order to do that disturbed mind to settle down a bit, in a neutral way, it is very, the thinking about or concentrating about the breathing in and out will help you. So once you did that, your mind is in a set in a sense of a neutral. So after that, you can generate about the refuge taking and also generation of the mind for enlightenment. You meditate on four immeasurable qualities. While remitting in the Buddha, the Dharma, and excellent symbol, you generate the spirit of enlightenment. You recite Om Sobhava. All phenomena are devoid of inherent existence and that they dissolve into emptiness. This is a little bit related to Tantra. So, but there is no detail. So it's just about generating one's merit field. Om. And when you speak about Om Subhava Shuddha, it speaks about no self. And Savadharma Subhava is about the no selfness of phenomena. And when the Hung terms, it's represent the pride. And here it refers to the pride that is derived from the practice of the mind that realizes the emptiness. So it speaks about the meditating on the emptiness. From emptiness, in space in front, on the precious throne, both high and wide, borne by eight great lions, as we see that the bubbles come from the water. So similarly, when we speak about from emptiness, the mind that realizes the emptiness itself, we should be able to see it in the form of our deity in front of us. The mind that realizes the emptiness should spring from the emptiness itself. In the sixth session yoga, that in the space in front of us, that we visualize all about all the deities. So here the space, open space, doesn't mean the open sky in front of you. It's more about our internal space. And in the Tantra, one should be able to have an understanding about the subtle mind and, of course, the stages of dissolvement. And even though you may not be able to go into very detail thinking about the dissolve, but the clear light and from the mental or sight, all those destructive external things are dissolved or stopped, and whatever realizations or the understanding that one had before about the understand emptiness, so we can remember those or generate that at that time. So in this way, it's very important that we must meditate upon emptiness. Otherwise, we just generate the deities and the protectors. And of course, you might have a very clear vision or manifestation in your mind. But it's very difficult that it will be an antidote to the mind that looks everything as inherent, existent. So when we question about all this practice of the visualization of the deities, how can this be the antidote to the afflicted emotions? And there are questions such as this. So these are the questions that are very important, that how can this practice of the Tantra can be an antidote to the afflicted emotions? So the thing is that all these manifestations of the deities, even though the focus is to the deities, but the appearance should be empty. So focus upon an object which is the deity, and from it we have to look at that object as empty by itself. So with that as an object of emptiness, so in the great treatise on the Tantra by Lama Tsongkhapa, he says that there is a very short outline about how the object should be, how the mind should be the object, and from the object itself appearing as empty in the one who's mind. So even though there is no difference from the point of the emptiness, but the object makes a difference. So when we say here, from the emptiness, is very important. In space in front, on the precious throne, both high and wide, borne by 8 great lions, and on a seat formed by sun and moon disks and by a multicolored lotus, appears the Lama who teaches you this path from our guide. He is surrounded by the masters of the lineage of vast activities, those of the lineage of profound view. Although you do not move from the pure Dhamma sphere, with compassion you consider countless sentient beings in the 10 directions, who develop the activities of all the conquerors, all gurus of the 3 times, come hither with your retinue, and protector of all sentient beings without exception. Having invited in this way, you visualize the bathhouse scene. In an exquisitely fragrant bathhouse, you offer ablutions, wipe their bodies, and present clothing and ornaments, saying, out of compassion for me and all beings, and so forth, you make offerings and request them to remain as merit-filled, and they describe in Bodhicharya Avatara. As it says about, and I feel that the term, the lineage of the practice, I do not think that word is evident in the great treatise on the path of enlightenment. So when we speak about the lineage of the practitioners, it is in terms of the individuals from the Telopa, Narupa, and the great masters such as Dibhuva. So they have the visualization, they have the manifestation and appearance of the deity in their for themselves, and they practice this immediately. As fifth Dalai Lama says that those lineage coming from Lama Tsongkhapa, especially about the Vajrabhairava, so those are in terms of individual person. But generally, Lama Tsongkhapa speaks about the teachings about whole perspective from a general audience. So therefore, his teaching doesn't pay attention or more importance to the individual's realizations. Next, you practice the sevenfold prayer that condenses the key points for purification and accumulation. First, you say your body condenses all Buddhas and great compassion and Tathagata Vajradhara, Telopa, who have realized the supreme view, the lineage of bliss. Practice, you say Maitreya, Asanga, Vasubandhu, and Vimuttisena. For the lineage of vast activities, and Bodhisattva Nagarjuna, who destroyed the extremes of existence and non-existence, for the lineage of profound view, you say, who before the conqueror, for Adisha, you the spiritual master of all, for Dromtemba, our Lokdeshwara, great treasure of universal compassion, as well as scriptural knowledge and reasonings. And here the mental offering as being presented from the text of the Abhidhamma text, and also as being explained in the Kalachakra, that the earth is the flat, and then the center, the Mount Meru, and all those settings. If we have to accept literally all those explanations, and then of course we are going against the reality, so we cannot accept as literally of all those explanations evident. And in Kalachakra, it speaks about 34 different samsaric walls, and from the tip to the from the head tip to the toe, there is a way to symbol, there is to represent all those things. So at that time, during those time in India, there may be a way in a popular manner. In a popular manner, there may be a way to. There may be such assertions or views, so it may be explaining more about these things. As we discussed earlier, in the 6th century, one of the great scholars, in the 5th century, one of the masters of Nagarjuna says that the earth is sphere, not flat. And at that time, some Hindu masters debated the argument, saying, and at that time the scholar to be debate is the Nalanda master. So when we speak about 5th century, So it's much, much earlier than the Western philosophy advances. It is something that this concept is being explained in India, even in 5th century, which is much ahead of the Western philosophy advances and progresses. This is something that we have to know. And in that sense, is there no beneficial in doing in mental offering? Then that is not the case. It just represents, that is for the representation. It may not have to be actual as we feel. As we say that all the offerings of our mental, body, speech and mind, may I take it into the offer, whether it is being owned by someone or whether it is not owned by someone. So all the phenomena and all the objects that exist, even the enlightened and all the samsaric, that we mentally offer all this to our guru. And in particular, all the entire world, this which forms upon our own karmic realism, and also nowadays all the different galaxies that we explain, is all the countless number of the countless number of the worlds. So all these worlds and the stars and everything we can mentally offer as a means of offering. As well as other great offerings up to abiding individually in clouds. You recite the general confession 3 times. You say, from all the ill deeds I've done up to, I dedicate all to realization of Amtalam. And the Lamrim lineage prayers of opening the door to supreme path till the Lama Tsongkhapa himself, it was composed by Lama Tsongkhapa. And the outline was done by Rading Rinpoche. And the 3 different lineage. The masters of 3 different lineages are all the masters came into his visualizations. He has a vision of all the great masters. And ultimately, the Lama Adisha and the Lama Adisha put his hand on the head of Lama Tsongkhapa. So he has a very strong and a clear realization at that time. So at that time, Lama Tsongkhapa, having all those visions, he composed the Lamrim lineage prayer, the opening door of the spiritual path. And all the sentence carries a name of the masters. It's not about the nature of the sentence or the beauty of the sentence. The way that he composed is through having generated deep realizations, having deep realization and a vision of all these masters. Next thing, debate to excellent lengths and your natural abides. So once the whatever the deities that we have visualized, it's not that it dissolves in you. Let them debate to their own heavenly abodes. If you practice in 4 or 6 sessions, you ask them to debate in the final session only. These are the preliminaries to the way to rely on the spiritual masters. And when we practice the Guru Yoga, in Tibet is a land where both the Sutra and the Vajrayana are practiced simultaneously in a very popular way. And also in the Tantra teaching, it is very important to have all the visualization and the Guru Yoga at the beginning. So all the first, it's very important that the guru is considered is very important. So all this practice, whatever you call it, whether you call it guru yoga or any other. So the thing is, whatever that your master directs or instructed you, so you follow them. And you supplicate to your masters that may all his realizations and wish be fulfilled. So these are all, this is about the guru yoga. And this is very, very much related to the Tantra practice. And all the different sects of the Sayaka Yunyama in Tibet. So the Guru Yoga and the related practices are very important and practice irrespective of all the sects in Tibet. So Guru Yoga is practiced commonly and popularly in all the different sects of Tibet. So there are a difference in the sentence and the words they use, but the essence of the reality, the essence is same in all the sects. these are the preliminaries to the way to rely on the spiritual masters, the Guru Yoga relating to Lama Tsongkhapa. In a popular manner, is from the Jitun Sherab Senge, and it is the Ganden Lhagyama, or the descendant of the 100 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas from the Tushida. And from Java Vensava to the lineage of the Vensa lineage to so that is the popular one which comes from the Java Vensava. So which is related to the tantric practice. Then there is another Guru Yoga from the Kedub Chugyu. I think there is no lineage that exists at now, which is something related to the Madhyamaka philosophy. So in popularly, so whether you want to receive the initiation or not, everybody can practice the Ganden Lhagyama. To actually rely upon them, you reflect using analytical meditation thinking. As Lama Tsongkhapa speaks, Lama Tsongkhapa said in the Great Exposition that the term meditate is not a very simple one. So, and he there further speaks about the placement meditation and the analytical meditation. And Gondor Rinpoche also spoke in the commentary or the fourth chapter of Abhisamaya Alamkara that he speaks about the meditating of the actual subjective nature of the mind and also objective nature of the objects. So in this way, there is a lot of different ways of meditating. So when we speak about meditating about the mind itself, so the thing is, one generates that mind itself within our own mental stream. So when we speak about meditating on devotion or compassion, which means that one generates the compassion within ourselves. Also in terms of the primary and the secondary minds, when we speak about meditating those minds, when one of the mental factors within us generated into the understanding of the emptiness, then we see, we practice the mind that understands the emptiness. And when we speak about this, when we speak about meditating or impermanence or no-self, which then speaks about that particular mind meditating or understanding that phenomena, which is the non-self or the impermanence. So one of the most important factor that can move our mind is analytical meditation. So just merely placing your mind on an object, of course it is necessary to train our mind or to accustom our mind to an object or to any practice, but one needs an analytical meditation to enhance or to check the nature of the thing, which will generate a deep understanding within yourself. So once one have such realizations out of analytical meditation, one generates a deep devotion from the hearts of our heart. And once we have such a devotion, then that devotion is a very wishful or which arises by itself without the necessary to make extra effort for it. So otherwise, if you just daily, like we take foods, if you practice in that way, it is very difficult, or that there will be a transform in your mind. One needs the wish from oneself. Then, of course, one needs the faith and the devotion to do that. So one have all the powers and all the five combinations of the mind, and also the remembrance and the meditative stabilizations. So having all those gathered, then one can proceed further to gain further realization. So therefore, the analytical meditation is very important. So for analytical meditation, one need to understand the nature reality of that object. So with that, we need to understand the first, the explaining the other system, then giving one's own system, then refuting further arguments. So based on this logical way, through the Dhammakriti and the other great masters, text becomes very important here. Their kindness is great, like a doctor with a sick person. A lama cure the disease of suffering. If I have the wonder and lesson samsara from beginless time until now, it is because I did not meet excellent spiritual master or met him. So here, the generating the faith, and after that, generating the faith, remembering the kindness of one's master. Now I must do whatever pleases the lamas, just as it is kind to give a single bowl of food to a person dying of hunger, than it is to give a fistful of gold coins to someone who is fully satisfied with food and riches. So it is for me, as it says in the five stages, as the Buddha explains. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that we will have a vision of those Buddhas and Bodhisattvas once we have a deeper realizations, having improvement in our meditative serenities. As Lama Tsongkhapa says that once we improve with the meditating, calm abiding meditations and the spiritual insight, so when we combinedly practice and when the quality of those mind increases, then the deities and the protectors and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come to you as a form of vision automatically. But for the beginning, Lama Tsongkhapa, while staying in his homeland, Chogyur Dendro Rinpoche, who was his teacher, used to be very kind to him, and he advised him to go to the central Tibet to study. So that is really very kind of his master. So to have a vision of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and to hear their voice directly, of course, one is already in a very high state of levels to have such facilities. But once we are in such deserted state where there is no one to look after you, then it is our only spiritual master that explains and that shows you the love and the teachings. So which here the master also becomes a companion. And when the master shows a very a common appearance to you, even though the body is also the flesh and the bones, so the common here doesn't refer to the physical appearance. It's more about the mental, where the mental is full of afflicted emotions. So the master which seems to have all those mental afflicted emotions is our master who have the common appearance. And with such masters, we have, due to the only reason that our masters come in this common appearance, that's the reason why we're able to receive the teaching, receive the vows of the bhikshu, the full ordination vows, and so on. So if our master doesn't come in such common appearance, we will be in no position to receive any teaching directly from our masters. So therefore, we have to remember that our master's appearance in a commonly is one of the main factors which make it possible for us to see and to get the blessings and all those things directly from masters. So therefore, we should be very grateful to our master for his common appearance. And the detail about how to rely upon the master is very detailed in the liberation in the palm of hand by Pabongka Rinpoche. My Lama is a true conqueror. He is my unique superior deity. As he gives oral instructions perfectly, my virtual master is greater than the Buddhas. Accordingly, contemplate the fact that the master's kindness is indeed even greater than the Buddhas. In the past, when our guide heard a single verse or even just half a stanza, such as, if there is a Buddha, there is a death. Happiness is the cessation of this, to repay the Guru this kindness or to please him. He would offer hundreds of thousands of gold coins, not to mention his princely sons, wife, vessels, and the rest. He also struck 1,000 Buddha lamps into his body and offered everything he owned. In the life story of Lord Buddha, it is something that is a power, speaking about the power of truth. And as I was for the sake of the ill person, I have offered everything from my wife, son, and all my belongings. So it shows the Lord Buddha has really worked very hard for the sake of truth. And so since I work very hard and strive so much for the sake of the truth, so may the power of truth becomes very strong. I am the follower of the guide. Now I am able to receive countless teachings from my masters. As the thousands and the millions of Buddhas have come to this world, but they are not able to conquer untamed mind fragments. So you are the only masters who came to give the direct teaching to us, even at a time where there is no teaching of Buddha in this world. So from the Nagarjuna and the Aryadeva and the masters from Dalma Tsongkhapa himself, so even though they have their fame and their fame spread all over the world and they have so much to do for themselves, but still they care so much for their disciples. So we are very unfortunate that we are not there to have the direct vision of them, to see them directly or to meet them. But what they have left is really a source of a text in our hand, which contains all the nectars and the essence of the teachings. So, which is something that can be ready to eat and drink and taste. So, of course, they may not be equal in terms of understanding to the Buddha, but in terms of the kindness and the gratefulness, they are equal to the Lord Buddha himself. So if we contemplate in this way, those masters who give direct teachings to us are really, their kindness is equal to Lord Buddha himself to us. I am the follower of the guide. Now I am able to receive countless teachings from my masters. Their kindness is indeed unlimited. This is when a master has great learning, people acknowledge his great kindness. If he does not only do they lack the slightest consideration for him, they heartily says, I heard the Dharma from him, is they had done him a favor. This attitude is utterly wrong. For example, even though one's parents are uneducated, one must acknowledge their kindness. Doing so will be very beneficial and failing to do so very prejudicial. It is the same in relation to the spiritual masters. Now when a person helps someone a little financially, he feels it was very kind of the person to do so. And the lamas ensure one of the happiness in all lives, present and future. When I examine the situation well, it is clear that the good or bad circumstances of all beings from Buddhas and Bodhisattvas down to simple households are determined by whether or not they have pleased their teachers. So the main important is the offering of in terms of your practice, and the main important is to obey one's master wholeheartedly. Furthermore, the lamas have allowed many people to achieve Buddhahood in a single lifetime. If I please my teachers with these three kinds of offerings, I too am sure to realize Buddhahood quickly. As we pray that in the lives and lives to come, that may be able to be in the feet of all the great masters, then if we are praying in this way, it is very important that one should be doing service to all the masters that directly give teaching to us, because they are the source of all our future benefits and accomplishments. Therefore, there is no alternative but to rely on my masters flawlessly. Page number 118. In brief, as all the sutras and commentaries explain repetitively, be sure to please the gurus. I shouldn't see this as a burden, an undesirable choice, or an obligation. For who does not want merit? In the sutras, the tantras, and their commentaries, everywhere it is taught that for the accumulation of merit, there is no spirit superior to the gurus. What pleases the gurus is meditating faith, not superficially but from the depths of your heart. This consists in seeing only goodness in all they do and does not allow for even the slightest perception of faults in them. Lama Tsongkhapa speaks the teaching in general. Therefore, in the Lamrim Chemu, he speaks even in the masters, there may be Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, or even those who are not yet in the path. So whatever your guru or the teacher may be, so there might be many instances that he do not have the realization or understanding of a particular subject, or maybe due to some reasons or purpose, he may show a different form. Then if he happens to speak something which is against or something which is not accordance to the teaching of Buddha, then we must refrain from these teachings. Lama Tsongkhapa also says that there is a quote one from the life stories of Lord Buddha. Therefore, it actually is very important that one should wholeheartedly listen to one's master and should be able to see everything as perfect. But then, of course, one needs to have the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. And such examples are how the Naraba did service for his master Teloba, and Jizumela did the service for his Marba. So, but these are different cases whom have really very deep realizations, are in the high state of level. So these are some exceptions, and we have to know that these exceptions. As in the precious garland, it says that there is a general and there is something special or exception. So this is something popularly exists in all the teachings, and we should be able to differentiate these differences. Although they appear to have flaws, it is my perception which are impure. How could the Guru have such faults? In the past, Arya Sangha, having meditated on Maitreya, saw him as a beach, her hindquarters infested with maggots. Naruba saw Teloba roasting live fish and so on. Furthermore, in the Sutra of the Father and Son Meeting and elsewhere, it is explained that the Tathagata will also manifest himself as a demon to ensure the welfare of sentient beings. It is not possible that the Gurus have flaws. They are a Buddha in the flesh. If you fail to reflect on this, you will then see flaws in the masters and be led to scorn them and so on, which explained in the Guhya Samaja Rutantra, in the 50 verses of Guru Devotion and elsewhere. It is the greatest sin among all sins. Following the example of Dromtempa's life, I will not heedlessly seek out many teachers. In relation to whatever lamas I follow, I must be sure to avoid having even the slightest disrespectful thought, even at the cost of my life. Jarumbache says, then seeing that whatever goodness you see in this life or the next depends on its excellent causes being brought together, the main one being fervently in thought and in deed, correctly relying on perfect masters who teach the path, never abandon them even at the cost of your life, and please them by offering them the implementation of their advice. I, the yogi, practice in this way. You who aspire to liberation, do the same. If it is necessary, therefore, to rely fervently upon the spiritual masters who teach the path and to please them by offering them the implementation of their advice, you may wonder exactly what the advice that you are able to carry out is, and how to practice having relied on the spiritual masters, to how to take the essence of these human rebirths. And here it speaks about the importance or how the fortunate having such a human rebirth. Now that for once I have attained a human rebirth, it would be a great mistake not to ensure that I do not leave it empty-handed. I must immediately put a stop to all three kinds of worldly concerns, black, white, and a mixture of two. On the one hand, nothing will be worse than listening to the Dharma or teaching it, guarding my precepts and the like purely out of concern for overcoming my enemies, caring for my friends, impressing others, or motivated by a wish for personal gain and honors, for then I will fit to engage in a sincere spiritual practice by meditating impermanence and the rest. On the other hand, based on my present life, nothing would be better practicing the Dharma purely, for then I would not let myself down and I would plant the roots for lasting happiness. I shall turn from worldly activities, which are as vain as winnowing chaff, unimportant and dangerous. I shall take full advantage of my present life with its great potential so that I do not have to die with regrets. Furthermore, I will do as of now. In this way, you should meditate until the desire to use your freedom and fortune becomes as strong as thirsty person's attraction to water. Charambache says, this life with freedom is superior to a wish-granting gym, but it is as if you have attained it just this once. It is difficult to achieve, easily destroyed. So here is a identification of the advantages of having a leisure life. And eliminating the obstructions to having a leisure life. And as we know that the profound or the best quality nature of the result, also the causes which brings that kind of result should be contain such different qualities. So therefore, such a quality of leisure and advantages that we have this human body. Of course, the causes having the practice of ethical discipline and prayers and supplications is also very profound. So therefore, such kind of the causes. So one need to analyze and check whether we have such those special causes within us. As it is said that in the common human beings and the sentient beings, it's very difficult that one have all these practices and may end up going to the hell and other lower rebirths. And for us, we have taken all the precepts and the vows. We have taken the precepts of the Bodhisattva vows, and we have also taken the Tantra vows. And from the Lama Tsongkhapa's texts and commentaries, we have heard the Lama Rinpoche. We have also read the commentaries of the fundamentals of Medivh, and also the Tantra, the five stretches of the paths, and also the great exposition on the Tantra. So these texts are ready for us to be practiced and put into implementation. So the instructions are right in front of us. The instruction which has all the, which are based on reasons. And even though there is such instruction which comprise of all these qualities, and if there is no one practicing it, then of course it is really a waste of our energy, a waste of such an instructions. So to accumulate virtues, of course, one need to put effort to do it. Otherwise, the negative actions and the karmas will come by itself automatically. The white or the virtues and the positive actions need to be put hard strife or effort in order to do it. So, but if you are from a different religion or if you do not have a faith in religion, it's different. But here, since we are all a follower of a religion, and of course a follower of Lord Buddha, then we should be really something different from the other followers. And having such an encouragement ourselves, one should be look forward to make each our daily life very meaningful. And as the days become weeks and weeks become month and month to year, and as the decades, so in that way, as the time and year progresses, one's life becomes meaningful. So we have to make sure that the human body that we have, which comprise of the leisures and advantages, we have to put it in practice to make use of it. Even for myself, there is no time for me to meditate with the on sessions and the interval sessions. There is no time. And maybe one part is my laziness. But whenever I get up in the morning, first I remember about the great compassion of the Lord Buddha. And I always remember the stanza or the verse of which reads out the compassionate qualities of Buddha. When I speak about the qualities, the compassionate qualities of Lord Buddha, and also the realization, the qualities of realization is about the wisdom that understand the emptiness. So these two qualities of the Lord Buddha, then I contemplate on it. Then I do the blessing of the speech. So I try my best to, momently when I woke from my sleep, I always create my motivation in this way. So it really helps the whole day in all my activities. So if this can be done for the weekly basis and for the month and years, so in the time to come, gradually, there will be a little transformation and change to the continuation of the our mind. As the Kadamba Master says that even though the focus and the meditating should be and is very difficult, but if we put effort, that even though something which may not come in hundreds of years may be realized in a short time. But I'm not saying that I have great realizations. As I explained before, whatever is written in the text and the sutras, I'm really putting my best effort. And by the result is that I myself feel very happy and calm. And even though it may not be so helpful, but when some difficult situations and the problem arises, I'm able to tackle those problems in a positive way. As we say that if one is in a joyous mood, then one must dedicate all those to the joy of all the others. And when you have a suffering or the problems, one should dedicate that all the sufferings of the sentient beings you are taking upon your own shoulder. As Shantideva also says that as long as the space endures and the sentient being remains, may it too remain to expel the suffering of the sentient beings. And the bodhicitta mind, which is once we generated the bodhicitta mind, then from there onwards, there will be always happiness, and it will improve and it will get better than once. So once our mind get accustomed to use to these practices, then it will come quite easily in our way. As Fifth Dalai Lama says that whatever the qualities that he has gained it through effort. He has put effort to get it. And he is just pointing to us that, so when Fifth Dalai Lama says that whatever he has learned and studies is through effort, which gives a direction to us that we need to put effort in order to have any kind of realization. Similarly for me also, whatever realizations or understanding of the texts of the Nagarjuna and the Soul Masters, I'm always trying to read them. It's not, the reading is also not just reading fast, but contemplating about the meaning of those texts and sentences, and also thinking about all the texts generally. As Lama Tsongkhapa himself says that we should not be satisfied with just one or two texts or just a gross meaning of the text. One should be striving to understand the subtle or try to study more texts. And also the commentary by the Buddha Palita and also Bhava Vivekas, the mirror of the wisdom. So in this way, if we read the text, we will come to understand the what is the vision or the understanding or his view of that certain scholar. So what are the difference between different scholars? But it's not that we just have different, you know, all the different views, but we should be also trying to see what are the origin of those things. And when Chandrakriti explains, when Chandrakriti answers the arguments coming from the Bhava Viveka side, then we should be able to see from which sources or how authentic they are. So all this, if we are able to study or analyze in this way, then of course the great masters have composed this text and it is purpose. It suits its purpose. And I also taught during the Kalachakra teaching that we always request through the seven offerings and may all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come and give ultimate teachings. If all, I then in a playful manner I say that if we see Nagarjuna and everyone and tell them to give us teaching, then Nagarjuna will tell us that I have composed this great text and you are not studying it. Then there is, those texts are in front of you to study, but you are not doing it. He may say so. So there are such a vast and extensive texts and commentaries available, but what we do is, in order to clear the obstacles, we do a quick reading of those texts by some monks. and also the canons of the Tengyur, the translation of the Buddha's direct discourses and the commentaries, and of course filled with the intelligence, filled with the intellectuals and the understandings. But of course, one for an individual, it will be very difficult to have a general understanding of all these vast texts. But then your own set of the texts that is being studied by each monk, you can concentrate on it. And also, it is divided into the refuting the other system, then presenting one own system. Then in terms of paramita, I try to memorize the presenting one own systems, the definitions, the categories, and the measures. So I just recite on this, and this is not going to last long. So what are the reasons behind those things, and what are the importance of these things? And through them, how it can transform our mind, how it can affect our mind. Also, we have to look about the life stories of the previous masters. So in this way, it will have not just that everything is in your mind. And we have to know that these texts of your respective teachers also are based on Lama Tsongkhapa's texts. And Lama Tsongkhapa's texts is also based on Nagarjuna's texts. And Nagarjuna himself is based on the great sutras. And if that is the case, then Lord Buddha has given the teaching of not four noble truths. And also the Dhammakriti. Again, then there is no necessary for Dhammakriti to again explain the Four Noble Truths so extensively with reasonings, because it is already explained by Buddha. So that is not the case. We have to find the reason behind it. So once we analyze further and try to find the reasons behind all these things, we will further gain more understanding, a more steadfast or a stronger, and that will last longer, which will bring more effect, ever long-lasting effort. And by the result of studying the Dhamma texts, one should be able to transform this understanding and realizations as an antidote to one's own afflicted emotions. And one should be able to crush the ever-strong afflicted emotions that is present within us. If one is able to make the afflicted emotions and also the mind, the self-cherishing mind, if you are able to crush these two with your understanding and the studying of the text, then of course you will, our mind, that study of those things will feel really proud. Otherwise, just taking a quote from this text or sutra won't be of any use. And for example, in terms of the Bodhisattva Avatara, engaging in the deeds of Bodhisattva is explains very extensively about the generation of the mind of Bodhicitta, and also the fundamental of the wisdoms. And so text really concentrates and explains detail about the emptiness. And the purpose of your study is not to just pass your exams. So in this way, if we are able to practice, then of course the life, our precious life, with all the leisures and advantages, will be really purposed. So now, greasing for tea.
So human beings have this extraordinary intelligence, and by using this, of course, you need to also meet with the conditions in order for us to shine forth with this intelligence. From the point of view of Buddha, Buddhism, and as Buddhists, we have the guide in the teachings of the Buddha for us to make use of this intelligence, so in order for us to shine forth. And so by using intelligence, one should make this human life a meaningful one. And so for that, one needs first to recognize this life which has leisure and fortune, freedom and fortune. As humans, we are social animals, like, and even in the case of animals, if they are social animal, the individual members have to, for their survival, depend on the rest of the herd or group. And so we need to recognize and acknowledge that. So, for example, in the case of honeybees, they are also social animals. The bees, all by themselves, alone, individually, cannot survive and live their life. And so the other bees take care of their babies, and then they also produce the offsprings and so forth, and their life goes on like this. And so they need a sense of community and sense of care for each other, one another. For example, when some danger or threat comes to the hive, beehive, all of them work together to resist. And so this is not due to religion or anything like that, but because of the reason for their survival. They're social animals. They do that. So as social animals, we as human beings also need to do that. But what we do is we neglect the society, the community that we will live in, and we only indulge in selfish goals. So if in the case of animals, the animals, social animals, work together for their survival and work together, whereas humans, we are too intelligent, perhaps, and therefore we actually ignore the welfare of the rest of the beings, people in our society. We only think of our own goal, fulfillment. So if you wish really to be selfish, if you can actually, you should consider the rest of the members of our society in order to fulfill your selfish goal as well. And so instead of doing that, we try to deceive others, we try to bully others, we try to do things that are against our wish for happiness. In our childhood, early childhood, we have the children do not make discrimination on the basis of color, religion, and so forth. But so they have this true human nature. As we grow up, we then make distinction between which race we belong to, and within the races, we also make discrimination as to which social status we belong to, high or low, and so, or someone with authority and money and so forth. So we don't acknowledge the fact that depending and working with others brings us true happiness. But we are more focused on making money, thinking that money will bring us all our wishes. And education itself is also oriented to material gain and money. And so today, many people are becoming aware and complaining that we do not we lack moral ethics. And so education, people say that education must be linked to moral ethics as well. So here we are talking about giving secular ethics, education in terms of secular ethics, education of secular ethics, in order to teach people about moral ethics. Because if we were to use religion as a means for ethics, then we in the world there are non-believers. For them, we would lack any means. So this secular ethics is something that has been practiced in India for thousands of years. So in the past, there was this non-Buddhist tradition called the followers of Charvaka. And so most of the religious traditions, the spiritual and philosophical traditions, criticized the Charvaka's followers, whereas the practitioners themselves were regarded as sages. So here, what was done was that the philosophical view was actually critiqued, but then and rejected. But the practitioners were respected, and so here also we are talking about respecting all kinds of traditions, religious traditions. So many of the problems that we face today are on our own creation, human creation. So, of course, animals live quite selfishly, but because they lack this intelligence that we have, they are not able to cause so much trouble. But because we have this intelligence, we cause all kinds of problems and havoc in our society today, everywhere. So at present, there are 7 billion people, and at the end of this century, 21st century, it is said that the human population would be 10 billion. And then, of course, the natural disasters would increase. So unless we are able to promote this unity amongst humans to take responsibility for the whole of humanity, our problems and difficulties would increase. This is something that we can predict. And therefore, today, there are everywhere around the world, there are many people who are paying attention to the study of mind, understanding the mind, especially amongst the scientists and particularly the medical scientists. So this gives some hope to us. Otherwise, if it's countries like Japan and have very high material development and progress, and then people's living standards are high, but nevertheless there are more and more number of suicides. And then in the case of Ladakh and Sikkim, there didn't used to be any cases of suicide, but today it is increasing, and this especially happens amongst the younger generation. So what happens is when they become too unhappy and frustrated, then they lack the lesson, the spiritual lesson to combat those problems, and then become desperate. And so as humans, as social animals, we need love and compassion. and take the responsibility for the whole society, because this is what demands, what our own society, community demands. Because if you think and care about the well-being of others, then you will also fulfill your own goal. As Jerembuche says in Lam Rim Chemo, that although the practitioners of Bodhisattva Jnana are dedicated for the benefit of others, as a byproduct, they also benefit themselves. And therefore, we need to see the shortcomings of the self-cherishing attitude and then overcome it. And if you can do that, then you will make this life meaningful. And so this kind of thing can be done on the basis of this kind of human life that we have. And so we need to see the meaningfulness of this society. And then thinking about the rarity of finding such a human life with all kinds of qualities, then you should also decide to practice the spirituality, the Dharma. Go to the text. Reflect upon this. And if it is important to make fully meaningful to your attainment of a life with different kinds of freedom and fortune, you may wonder how you are to do so. Two responses are given. The first concerns understanding how to ascertain the spiritual path in general. Given its importance, I will now explain it in brief, briefly in two steps. How the path of the two kinds of beings incorporates the meaning of all scriptures. How showing why one is to be guided by the paths of the three kinds of beings. So how the path of the three kinds of beings incorporate the meaning of all scriptures. So with regard to the teaching of karma and taking refuge, of course, this is related with all the three different kinds of beings for spiritual training. But here it is taught within the context of the path of the beings of small capacity. So Buddha first generated the spirit of enlightenment, then worked on the accumulation and finally realized Buddhahood. All this was done for sentient beings' sake. Each discourse, too, was given solely for their benefit. The goals to be achieved, too, as to ensure sentient beings' welfare are twofold: temporary, a high rebirth, and ultimate certain goodness. All the Buddha taught to achieve the first is included in the topics of this actual practice, path of lesser beings, or in the path shared with lesser beings. The traits of lesser beings are given in the lamp for the path. Those who, by whatever means, take personal interest in the pleasures of cycling existence alone are known as lesser beings. And according to... compassion is the root of bodhicitta. So compassion is this feeling... the suffering of others unbearable, and therefore in order to understand what suffering is, we need to know what it is. So mainly we should think about the conditioning existential pervasive suffering first on oneself, and then you should move towards turn your mind towards others for compassion. And so by thinking about this suffering in relation to oneself, then you cultivate or you develop the determination to be free from suffering. And then, because you see the nature of suffering itself, you also wish others to be out of suffering and therefore cultivate compassion. So accordingly, this do not give great importance to the affair of this life, given that they are more concerned with achieving the happiness of a good rebirth in the next life. They practice the route to produce its causes. Certain goodness corresponds to either liberation, that is simple freedom from samsara, or omniscience, Buddhahood. All the Buddha taught to achieve from former is included in the topics of actual path of intermediate beings, or in the path shared with them. The lamp of the path says, with the will to turn from samsara's pleasures and the path whose nature is rejection of sin, those who are concerned with personal peace alone are known as intermediate beings. So he's almost making comment with regard to this term sin, the Tibetan word for digpa, which can also mean to scare you. And so what scares you is the negative karma and so forth, and which when you once you have created, it leads you to suffering. So thus, simple intermediate beings are said to turn their back to the good things of cycling existence and assert as their goal the attainment of a state of personal liberation that frees them from samsara. To achieve it, they engage in the practice of the three trainings. There are two methods to achieve a state of omniscience: sacred mantra and the perfection waka, both including meditation topics of great beings. On great beings, the lamp for the path says, those who, based on their personal suffering, want only to eradicate all the suffering borne by others, are known as superior beings. So accordingly, great beings are said to be overpowered by compassion to end all sentient beings' suffering, said Buddhahood as their goal. For that purpose, they train in the six perfections, the two stages, and so on, showing why one is to be guided by the paths of the three kinds of beings. Although the three kinds of beings are explained in this way, in the present context, they must understand that the two lower paths prepare you to be guided along the paths of great beings. And so the purpose of leading sentient beings through these three types of paths meant for the three types of beings is that it helps all types of beings who either have very low capacity of intellect or medium or great capacity. So when we usually think about suffering, we refer to the painful experiences, and we even regard the changeable sufferings as something pleasurable. And therefore, the changeable suffering and the pervasive conditioned suffering, we are not able to reflect on them. So for someone who is not able to think and reflect on them, if you teach their path, the means to lead to higher rebirth, then they would be able to at least cultivate the path leading them to higher rebirth. But for someone who is able to actually understand and take the teaching on bodhicitta, and once this teaching on cultivation of bodhicitta is given to them, they will be able to actually see the rest of the shortcomings of samsara and so forth, and selfish attitude and so forth, and that path alone will make them to restrain them to commit negative actions. Not only that, if they indulge in negative actions, it would harm them, but then they also can go on to the next level of restraining on harm to others, and because just as they themselves know that they want happiness, not suffering, likewise the others are the same in that sense. And therefore, with bodhicitta, as Maitreya says, it averts one on the lower realms of existence, rebirth in the lower realms of existence, and then And then it shows or leads one to higher realms of existence. As the Kadampa masters of the past have said, that we have, having found this kind of human rebirth now, and we have this intelligence and have the opportunity to study all these great texts, we should actually strive and to the best of our ability to cultivate bodhicitta, because that alone will overcome all the negativities and also help in accumulation of merit and wisdom. And then you'll be happy, healthy, and you'll be free from obstacles, on the contrary, while actually retaining this selfish attitude in deep in your heart, if you try to do the tantric practices and meditate yourself, visualize yourself as a deity, and then in the mandala and so forth, it doesn't help. So bodhicitta will help us and also to attain Buddhahood. And it is that means that will actually please the Buddhas, that it will help others, help other sentient beings, and help in repaying their kindness as well. So Shantideva says, I pay homage to the Bodhicitta, the ones who have attained this holy mind of Bodhicitta. This Bodhicitta, which helps one to work for those for the betterment of those who even hurt or harm oneself. And so, when once after having studied all these texts and applied the integrate these teachings within oneself of that bodhicitta. And you will not have any other choice but to engage in the cultivation of bodhicitta. So the reason why I was saying this is, so someone who is of greater capacity, if he or she is able to cultivate bodhicitta, and they should be taught this, given this teaching for cultivation of bodhicitta. But if someone is not able to, doesn't have that capacity, then they should be shown the other paths, such as avoiding the paths, means of leading to higher rebirth and so forth. And then let gradually so how actually to take full advantage this title, subsection, training in the mind on the path shared with lesser beings. First, you are to focus and reflect, I have attained a precious human rebirth that is so difficult to gain and so meaningful once achieved, but it will not last. I have to die. Since it is not sure when I will die, it is from this time forth that I must strive to use this life well. Until now, countless beings, good, bad, and indifferent, have been scattered by the lot of death as well. As people disperse from a marketplace, I am fortunate enough to have survived this long. Generate the awareness of death until your heart pounds and you cannot keep still. You should reflect. It is amazing. Even though we don't want to, we have to die and leave behind our wealth and belongings, our loved ones and companions. All that we take with us is the sins we committed for their sake. And the next passage also. And so the nature of this kind of life of fortune and freedom, and then the fact that to attain such, it is very difficult. The causes and conditions that bring about it are difficult to. And so when you think about these things, you will see how precious this life is. And then when you waste this life, you'll really feel sorry So what actually makes us waste this life is holding on to this permanence of this life that we'll live. So this, for that, we need to think about this kind of life as having come forth from. It is also because of this clinging to some kind of a cleanliness of the body, this body which actually has come through very filthy kind of substances from the parents' semen and egg and so forth. So unless we are really able to use this intelligence by understanding this kind of nature of this body, then we are not going to make this life a meaningful one. And then life is also impermanent. And so here we are talking about a coarser level of impermanence. Whereas in relation to the path of shared with the intermediate beings, we are meditating on the subtle aspect of impermanence. And so we should think about death and the nine different ways in which we can think about death, and then think that nothing helps at the time of death but the Dharma. So think about the inevitability of death, that it is uncertain when we are going to die, and then nothing but the Dharma can help us at death. So, of course, we would most of us could see that we are going to... death is quite inevitable for us, but unless you have a really, really strong clinging to yourself, that you will live. So, for example, the past kings. So, for example, Shahjahan, who actually built Taj Mahal, after making his laborers to build Taj Mahal, in order that this kind of monument may not be built in the future, he was said to have actually chopped off the fingers of the people who actually built that. So what does it look like now? This is due to this strong self-cherishing attitude, and also thinking that this monument will live forever, and you know, things like that. Holding on to the permanence of one's, and also the Chinese emperors have done such things, cruel things, to the laborers who have built monuments, and then these laborers were later buried under earth. And today we have another case in the story related to Syria. Many innocent, helpless children and other people are suffering. So I heard one BBC report. One of the correspondent, BBC correspondents, had gone there, gone to Syria, and he saw a few children hiding, and the children told him that their dad went to search for food for them, and they have been waiting for their dad for days on, but actually the dad had actually been killed in the battle. So, of course, when you're faced with challenges, you could, of course, face... but in the past, people fought face-to-face. But today, the armies and soldiers actually press buttons and then send forth the shoot the missiles to kill the enemies. So in Lhasa, so we have this kind of people in two groups in Lhasa, and then they will fight with each other. Before fighting, they would say, now I will fight with you, I will challenge you. So imagine, visualize, and imagine your guru on your head, sitting on your head, because I'm now going to fight with you. And then they engage in some kind of fighting. But today, the generals give command, and then they don't make any discrimination, and they just shoot missiles and bullets indiscriminately. So innocent people are killed, and also animals. So it's really unfortunate, really sad. So of course, the weapons themselves cannot kill humans unless it's used by somebody. So mainly, it is a person, when he or she uses the weapons, then they kill others. Whereas, again here, their negative emotions, destructive emotions, are to be blamed. And of these negative emotions, and of course they are in turn rooted in the selfish attitude. So because of selfish attitude, we think that we are protecting ourselves, and then we also become attached to the near and dear ones, on our people who are on our side, and then see others who are actually our adversaries as enemies, and then kill them. And then we have anger towards them. So our mind is totally disturbed with all these negative emotions, like anger, and all these are rooted in the self-cherishing attitude. So this the sense of permanence actually ruins us, brings all kinds of problems and difficulties. So seeing what is impermanent as being permanent, seeing what is unclean as being clean, seeing what is without self as having self, and seeing what is suffering nature as being joyful, I mean, these lead us to have suffering. So when you think about, when you reflect on the impermanence, then it will reduce our sense of permanence. So we all know that we are going to die in the end. But people who are very strongly attached to being living for a long, long time, like hundreds of years, of course, they may not see this. So medically these days, people say that the scientists may be able to make people live for a longer, long time. It's better if they could actually live a very peaceful life with a peaceful mind and not harm others. And but if you really live a very sinful life, it's better to die rather than live. So Bodhava has said, and as Bodhava has made this prayer, may the sinful die as soon as possible. So may the sinful have short life. This is what Bodhava used to pray. And so this sense of permanence and so forth actually gives us more problem and difficulties. So it's very important to think about the in the uncertainty when we are going to die. So someone who is healthy may think that I may not die. I will not die tonight because I am healthy. I have no sickness. And I won't have any obstacles to life. In Dharamsala, of course, it's prone to earthquake. So I heard from somebody that it's been 500 years since Delhi has not experienced a very strong earthquake. So this earthquake may happen any time now. It would be 8.5 or something on the Richter scale. So perhaps if that happens, then maybe I need to escape, flee to Mongolia. And then there's tsunami, which is happening. I was in Darwin recently, in June. And so there was a huge tsunami a few years ago, and some villages were actually wiped out. So you never know when we are going to die. And then there are conditions which are meant for living, for sustenance and life, but then they may cause death. People, of course, eat good food, and then they become fat, and then they also suffer heart attack because of cholesterol problem. And so these actually food are meant for one's living, for sustenance, but they actually turn out to be causes or conditions for death. So when you think about these things, even the things that are meant for sustenance of life turn into condition for death. So when I think back about my friends, people I knew, many of them are now only memory. And so I could say that, oh, such and such person is no more, such and such person no more, and so forth. And so when you reflect on this, it helps to think about my own death. So when you make the long life offerings to me, and I also act like I'm going to live long, I mean, actually, we are thinking or giving in to this sense of permanence. So with regard to Dharma, one should not postpone or procrastinate, but do it today. So if you think about impermanence and death in the daytime, or if you think about emptiness, for example, or bodhicitta in the daytime, then you will also have dreams of bodhicitta and your emptiness. So what I'm hoping is that I will be able to remind myself of bodhicitta and the view of emptiness. So even if I may not be able to have a very clear visions of or clear experience of the five stages or the different experiences during the resolution processes, if I could at least retain the bodhicitta and maintain my mind in the state of bodhicitta and realizing emptiness, it'll be helpful for my next life. So you should not feel completely desperate at the time of death, and full of anxiety and fear for what you have done in your life. And so many Westerners, they don't want to even hear the word death. And then cancer is something which even the doctors are not able to disclose to the patients, and the patients are not willing to hear. So there was one Gyentenbum, Tibetan Gyentenbum. When he became sick, he told me that he told his doctor to tell him clearly if he had cancer or not, not just hide it from him. And so he made it clear to the doctor. So many people even don't want to hear about what they are suffering, and their relatives, and as well as the patient themselves. But what we should do is think that we are going to die any moment. And then at the time of death, of course, I do many all of these different practices. The Vajrayogini and Vajra and so forth, Gurukula and so forth. And so I usually tell people that I go through, on a daily basis, I go through the death process 5 or 6 times. So when I go through these dissolution processes of the earth dissolving into water, and that into fire, that into wind, and so forth, what I'm doing this is I'm doing this expecting that I would be able to recognize, become aware of the clear light nature of at the time of the death. So with regards to bodhicitta and emptiness, the view of emptiness, I will be able to remember these two at the time of death. So with regards to bodhicitta, I have some kind of a degree of experience, and then also with emptiness, and I am maybe at a stage where I could be reach this inferential cognition of emptiness. So I was reading the Jesongkapa's commentary to Mula Madhyamaka Karika recently, and as I was reading the text, I felt that, oh, this is really what I am experiencing. And so what I'm saying this is not with the expectation that you would actually raise my status or you will make more offerings to me. In fact, I have already decided not to take any offerings for giving teachings many years ago. So I'm telling this expecting that it would be helpful to you, beneficial to you. Do you get that? And so with regards to the understanding of emptiness, the catalyst for me to take real interest in it was Ngodrup Tsognyi. And I was really interested in emptiness, but bodhicitta was quite far away, quite a far cry for me. I was thinking in those days. But then, after receiving teachings and having thought about bodhicitta, contemplating on it, I could feel, unless I am, what I'm lacking is the single-pointed concentration. Otherwise, I could feel that I would be able to reach the path of preparation. So these experiences are not just to be left in the text, but you need to actually integrate the teaching within yourself and then have the experience yourself, real experience, so that over the years, as you spend your time in training your mind in decades or so, then you will be able to have the experience. Now, in order to have the real experience, you need to really gain understanding. For that, you need really to study the text. And so it is very important that whatever you study is integrated and applied to yourself. So I'm not boasting that I have experienced this and that experience, but I'm actually telling this in order for you to benefit from this teaching so that you would also apply the teaching within yourself. When I die, I won't just disappear. So it is said that nothing but Dharma will be of any use to when you die. You may wonder then which spiritual practices will serve you when your life ends, and which non-spiritual activities will be harmful. So what helps in this kind of understanding that there will be a next life is to understand what is taught in Dharmakirti's Brahmana Vartika, where it says that something, a consciousness, is not given rise to by something which is not consciousness as substantial cause. And so I met once Sobut Lobsang, a Mongolian monk, and we discussed about the reasoning of this. So he made this gesture, holding his hand like this, and said, the reason that we use is that a just-born child is... the mind of a just-born child is, as the subject, it is mind because... the mind of that person will actually take rebirth because it is a mind. And so he said that this we have a very short statement, but the meaning within this is very vast. And so this mind, of course, is impermanent, changing every moment. And so this change that is brought about in the mind is just because it is brought about by the causes and conditions which... So something which is brought about through causes and conditions, that those causes and conditions which have brought about it themselves actually cause the disintegration of it. And so within the cause there are the substantial and the contributing factors, substantial cause and contributing factors. The substantial cause is a cause which actually turns into that effect. And so with regard to consciousness, it has to have a substantial cause which can actually become the next moment of consciousness. And for that, we need a previous moment of consciousness, not otherwise. And therefore, we have people today who stay in what is called meditative equipoise, even after clinical death. And so we have this mind or consciousness at the time of waking state, sleep, deep sleep and dream. And then there is a sensory perceptions as well as mental perceptions. And so the mere fact that these the sensory or mental perceptions have this quality of clarity and cognition is something that should give us the conviction that the mind comes from a mind and not any other factor as substantial cause. So as I was telling you this morning, that there was this about a scientist who said that he believes in next life. So, of course, when I have these discussions with scientists in Mind and Life conferences, and we don't really touch on religious matters, but sometimes on the side we kind of come up with some discussions. And so this scientist said that he was actually hoping that he would be able to work in the next life also with His Holiness the Dalai Lama to work for secular ethics and to for humanity. So when he said that, he was actually in tears. And so think, when I die, I won't just disappear. So first you have to think about the substantial cause of consciousness giving rise to another moment, next moment of substantial consciousness, which has this quality of clarity and cognition. And this has no beginning, as it is said in Tantra. In the Vajra Pinnacle, it is said that samsara is the called a continuum, and then nirvana is the next continuum. And so this continuum, this mind stream that we have, when it's full of negative emotions, we are in samsara. When we have overcome all these defilements and negative emotions that are in our mind, then the negative emotions, then you are in nirvana, which comes through the three poisons. When they are totally eliminated through the application, through the antidote, the countermeasures to them, then you reach nirvana. So you have to think about these very carefully. When I die, I won't just disappear. I'll have to be reborn. So only two kinds of rebirths are possible, happy and miserable. In any case, it is my karma that will decide for me. I have no free choice in the matter. It's 3 o'clock now. I'll have to be born wherever my black and white karma sends me. However, if I die, a virtuous thought is present in me. With a virtuous thought present, I'll be reborn in a happy realm. On the other hand, if I have a non-virtuous thought in me at the time, then I'll find myself reborn in one of the three lower realms, and will have to undergo horrendous suffering. With regard to this, with regard to which sufferings the lower realms entail, the protector Nagarjuna said these lines. So, as explained in this work, the hells, both hot and cold, involve suffering that it is not possible to bear. The torments of hunger and thirst that hungry spirits undergo are also intolerable, as animals are subject to stupidity and ignorance and to devouring one another. Their vows are impossible to endure as well. If you think now that plunging your hand into hot coals for a moment, remaining naked for about a day in the depths of winter, and going without food or drink for a few days, or being eaten alive by flies and so forth, would be difficult for you to withstand, how could you possibly be put up with the sufferings of the hot and cold hells of hungry spirits and animals who eat one another alive? Base your reflections on your personal experience and meditate until your thinking is transformed and you are terrified. What then are the methods to avoid rebirth in the lower realms that you should strive to apply? As explained earlier, you are to generate fear of the lower realm suffering. And once you have truly understood that three jewels have the ability to protect you from dread of them, you take refuge from the depths of your heart in the three precious jewels. Indeed, the three jewels can protect you from the horrors of the three realms. And so, with regard to the three jewels, you'll find the infallibility of the Buddha and so forth by studying very thoroughly what is taught in Pramana Vartika by Dhammakirti. And together with it, if you can combine the teaching on dependent origination, it will really help and inspire you. The Buddha jewel has overcome all personal fears. He is skilled in guarding others from all dread. So we need to, at this point, thinking about the Buddha being an authoritative of someone who is knowledgeable and who is authentic in helping others and so forth. We need to take information from Pramana Vartika, the second chapter. So from his qualities, you can extrapolate those of the Dharma and of the Sanghas. So since non-Buddhist teachers, doctrines, spiritual communities lack such qualities, they are not fitting refuges. It is the three jewels attributes which make them appropriate protectors. And then repeat, I take refuge in the Buddha, supreme among bipeds. I pray that they may serve as my guides for freedom. To freedom from the fears. And then also about the Dharma. So how the Dharma actually protects one is by actually developing these experiences within oneself. And then with regard to the Sangha, you request them to be your assistants. In this way, from the depth of your heart, take refuge with complete trust. Once you have taken refuge, if you fail to observe the precepts, your practice of refuge will decline. Consequently, you must train in them. Think, having taken refuge in the Buddhas, I will not embrace powerful worldly gods such as Vishnu as refuges. Moreover, I will consider an image of a Buddha's physical form as a true Buddha and revere it. Having taken refuge in the Dharma, I will not harm any sentient being. I will avoid disregard for so much as a single word of scripture, and instead respect it. Having taken refuge in the Sangha, I will not make true friends of non-Buddhists or bad companions, and will refrain from disrespecting anyone who wears the saffron robes, regardless of who he or she may be. Instead, I will honor them. And furthermore, once I have truly understood the great kindness of the three jewels, which are the sources of goodness, happiness, and virtue, I will present the offerings, the first portion of my food and drink, and so on. Seeing this, all immediate and long-term goals are achieved by supplicating the three jewels, I will refrain from continuing all ordinary fortune, teller, and the like. I will do all that I can encourage